listener production.
G'day, I'm Scott Phillips, the Chief Investment Officer of The Motley Fool, and welcome to The Good Oil. Now, if you're new to the podcast or you need a reminder, giving someone the good oil is giving them the good stuff, the important stuff, and the real stuff, which exactly is what we're trying to do with this podcast. We're bringing you conversation with entrepreneurs, executives, and experts, the people who know what's going on and the people who make things happen. And today's guest is someone who really knows what's going on. He actually fits two of these boxes. He is part entrepreneur, part expert, and his expertise is not so much on the outside, but on the inside. Professor Matthew Brown is a research professor working primarily on psychological and health aspects of gambling. His main expertise is in research methods and stats. Now, this is also cool. Before coming to the Central Queensland University, he worked in several research organisations, including the CSIRO and one German name that apparently means the Institute for Autonomous Systems. But for a time, he also ran his own commercial construction business. I don't know how many professors of psychology. I've also got a construction background, but we'll find out. Professor, welcome to The Good Oil.
Thank you, Scott. It's good to be here. Good to be here.
Mate, I really appreciate it. You and I have been engaging on Twitter for quite a while now, just backwards and forwards on different things. I've always enjoyed our interactions. And we were kind of, you know, going backwards and forwards about investing and kind of, I can't remember how the conversation came up, but we're talking about, you know, what was good investing and bad investing. I said, mate, you're probably closer to good investing than most because Warren Buffett would suggest it's temperament that makes the difference. We know the power of behavioral psychology when it comes to investing. So I reckon I'm speaking to the right bloke. Before we get into any of that though, can you give me a quick, well, okay, upfront. How do you go from running a commercial construction business to becoming a professor of psychology? And are there any others? Is there a hidden vein of research professors that are construction guys or short order cooks or something? What am I missing?
No, I like to think I'm unique in this respect. I had a career as a professional researcher. I did my PhD and I worked in various places of technical topics. I was there at the CSIRO, and it was a lovely job. It was fine, but I sort of saw this career mapped out in front of me, and at the same time, my dad was running this construction company. He was looking forward to retiring, and he tempted me to come over to the dark side and scrounge around in the dirt, signing contracts and dealing with tradies and building shit instead of researching stuff.
And so does being a statistical researcher make you a good construction manager? Does being a construction manager make you a good psychology professor, or are they just completely different parallel universes?
They're totally parallel universes. We did try to move towards a kind of more automated design process. One of the big costs is this, the technical drawings and planning it out, which can get expensive. And we sort of moved to Autodesk Inventor, which is like a three-dimensional engineering technical drawing, a bit of software. So I was able to use some of my technical skills there. But no, pretty much I had to learn it from the ground up. But I was very happy because I did a couple of things. One, I did manage and do the technical drawings for a very nice set of stairs at 111 Eagle Street in the Brisbane CBD. Nice. But I'm particularly glad managing the construction for a renovation to the engineering building at Queensland University of Technology. And I really wanted to walk into that building and tell those engineers that a psychologist.
they close the building and move next door, surely, at that point, wouldn't they? We're not staying here.
I made the call that this, I didn't want to do that for the rest of my life. You really have to love money a lot. Because it's a tough job. You've got to work six days a week, and you're working 10 hours a day at least, and it's very stressful. You're signing these contracts that are as thick as your arm, and you know that the principal contractors that you're dealing with will send an army of lawyers after you if you stuff up one thing. So who needs that stress? I went back to university, and I'm very happy.
Very, very good. Now, you talked about the love of money, which is a wonderful opportunity for me to just discreetly and without even anyone noticing segue into the question about your day job or your current role anyway, because you do specialize in the psychology of gambling. And I will bring this back to investing, by the way. For some of our listeners who are investors, this is a general podcast. We tend to err on the side of kind of business and the economy and the way things work. I'm going to make a completely random comment and let you tell me how wrong I am. I'm going to suggest that maybe the study of gambling is actually just the study of the economy in a very, very microcosmic kind of way. The idea of how people make decisions, of the things we think about risk and reward, of the way we treat and exchange money. Obviously, this is a very specific area, and I imagine a lot of your work is spent on the less savory aspects of gambling, or maybe there aren't any unsavory aspects. So I'll ask you that. Should we just ban gambling outright?
No, I wouldn't be in favor of just banning gambling outright, personally. But I would be in favor of putting some strong restrictions on the most pernicious types of gambling and the ways in which it's sold to vulnerable people and encourages them to think that they can actually make money from that.
So, Matt, we hear people say, hey, we're all adults, we've all got our choices, what can possibly be wrong with X? And X can be anything from pornography to drinking to gambling to advertising to whatever. I won't even try and attend tutorials. I'll ask you, if we're all adults here and we're all capable of making good decisions and we have a brain, and why shouldn't it just be a open slather free for all? You want to play the pokies, knock yourself out. You know you're going to lose your money, but if you want to play, it's up to you. You can simply choose not to. You can choose to walk away.
Yeah. So what you're outlining there is what you might call the individual choice, hyper-liberal way of thinking about it, which, you know, I have some sympathy for. You know, I spent too much money probably on single malt whiskey.
There is no such thing as too much money on single malt. Well, I should check the receipts first, but as far as I'm aware, it's not possible to spend too much money on single malt whiskey. But let's hypothetically assume it's possible. Keep going.
Yeah, so... you know, and I probably drink a little bit too much of that that is good for me. And we don't want to live in a society where, you know, people who know better than us are making all the decisions for us and ensuring that we're optimizing every single choice that we make to maximize our health and well-being. We want to, you know, freedom and autonomy is a good, and, you know, this is something we need to respect as well. On the other hand, I think where you draw the line is when, you know, there are products that are intrinsically quite dangerous, and then on top of that, they are sold and marketed in such a way as to encourage people to develop delusional beliefs about them and to separate them from their money. So, you know, most people understand the reasons why we do not allow selling of heroin during the hours of 6 to 8 p.m. on the TV. And it's because of those product safety issues. You know, yes, most of us can make a rational choice and say, hey, I won't do too much of that. It is a bit moorish, but I'm going to make a very rational decision there. But, you know, a significant minority of us will struggle with that. And I think just throwing it back in the court of the consumer and say, it's all on you, you've got to be the supremely rational agent that never, ever makes a wrong decision, you know, when it's not only hurting them, but it's hurting their families and the people around them pretty badly sometimes.
Yeah. I'm coming around to a view. I'm an avowed capitalist, as you likely know. But I'm also a fan of well-regulated capitalism, not free markets, right? And I think sometimes in particularly Twitter, where you and I spend too much time, the idea of the binary, right? You're either a free marketeer or you're a socialist. It's like, you know, there's very little time and space for what's in between. But I'm coming around to a view more and more that, you know, more and more money is being made by, in this case, companies, but there is a gambling element to this. And I won't ask you to stray too far outside your area, especially. You're welcome to, by the way, opine on anything you want, but I also recognize that I don't want to misrepresent your expertise academically. More and more companies are making an art form of bringing, you know, meeting us in a situation where we're bringing a knife to a gunfight. Everything from the advertising where they subliminally use the branding colors to make us think or do something, or the marketing that just says, you know, branding used to be, you can trust this brand. And then it became, you can like this brand. And then it kind of, marketing has turned into this exercise of manipulating us into things that aren't necessarily good for us. And it probably has always been thus to some degree, right? They sold, as you said, they sold cocaine in the newspapers once upon a time. So, you know, we're not exactly in new territory. But there is some element of our behavioral biases, you know, our evolutionarily retarded brains, I don't mean retarded in a disparaging way, I mean literally they are, the development is retarded by evolution. And we get to a point where people who are doing these things know exactly what they're doing. They know exactly all of our weaknesses. And so they say, hey, guess what? Come over here. I'm going to use your weaknesses against you and you won't even know it. How much of that is a microcosm of, or a macrocosm, I suppose, of the gambling example? How different is it? Where's the psychology kind of work for us at the moment?
Yeah, look, I think the way you articulate it is pretty similar to how I look at it. I mean, I'm fully in favor of capitalism and think it's generally fantastic. On the other hand, you know, companies don't want to compete with each other on a level playing field and drive each other down to the lowest possible profit margin. What they'd really prefer to do is have a captive audience that really, you know, just must have their product no matter whether they're having too much of it or not, and don't really have the option to easily kind of move away out of their product. And you see it with things that have nothing to do with gambling or addictive technologies. A lot of people talk about social media that you and I are frankly addicted to.
Right.
But, you know, even these sort of technology ecosystems created by companies like Apple. And I love my iPhones. Their products are a massive good to all of us. But at the same time, there is a massive asymmetry in terms of the way that they can manipulate the relationship and I have relatively little power to do so. Now, in the case of gambling, I suppose it's the pointy end of that stick. Now, I will say, by the way, that you can have perfectly healthy gambling. You know, you can have gambling products that have that don't cause problems and don't cause harm. For instance, lottery tickets. Instant scratch-up tickets. We've done analyses with data sets of like 60,000 people from population representative surveys across Australia, where we can sort of tease out the actual products to which we can attribute the gambling problems and harms. And it turns out that things like lotteries and instant scratch-its are responsible for essentially zero problems in Australia. And whereas you have something like the pokies, which is both dangerous and really prevalent, which is about 55% of all gambling problems in Australia. And then you have other forms like sports betting and casino table gaming, which are sort of equally virulent, equally dangerous, if you like, but fewer people currently play them than the pokies. So together they make up, say, maybe a remaining kind of 30%. So really it's the devil's in the detail, and you see the kinds of products where they, like poker machines are designed to be addictive, designed to maximize time on machine. And it doesn't have to be that way. People can have their fun and people can gamble, and it can be done in a way that isn't dangerous. But to be honest with you, not only the companies that run those products, but also the government, which is dependent on those revenues, and the rest of us who don't have a gambling problem, who benefit because those revenues get spent on good things that we like, lower taxes is one of them, we're all sort of involved in this sort of shell game where a small proportion of the population are copying a big financial hit so others can benefit, including, you know, ordinary people like you and me.
Yeah, speaking of capitalism, one of the things that always gets me, mate, is my old man was the president of the England RSL sub-branch, and then also, this is in New South Wales, Southern New South Wales, and also the RSL club, the licensed club. And it always fascinated me that the drive, even capitalism is a wonderful thing, but humans need for growth. They justify the pokies' losses so they can have cheap beer. And it was always that case, if we could get bigger, we could do X. And you kind of think, throwing more machines in there just so the beer can be 10 cents a schooner cheaper, it reminds me of the Whitlam song, you know, the blow up the pokies so they can make the trains run on time. And it's just that sense that you talk yourself into. And these are not for profits, which is remarkable to me. I would absolutely get, well, I wouldn't necessarily, doesn't necessarily justify it, but you understand the profit motive sometimes. When a not-for-profit licensed club, like, you know, I can name a dozen of them, I won't, decides to throw a whole lot of pokies in a thing so they can get bigger, so that they can, and they convince themselves that putting on a bus for the pensioners or you know, a cheap bistro meal or a schooner that's, you know, a dollar cheaper than the local pub is somehow a justified good. Is that the other side of this problem, the justification from both perspectives?
Yeah, I mean, I think economists sort of talk about it in terms of externalities. If you externalize the costs in the case of gambling, to some other people, and then you can reap the benefits in terms of cheaper beer and being able to sponsor the local footy team, and you get better facilities, all of these good things that we all get to enjoy, then it's a very tempting proposition. So it's a little bit like, carbon based generation, where if you externalize the cost of the environment, it's very cheap and very tempting.
Let me ask you, so what I love about your answer before about the types of gambling is I really love the science-based, the evidence-based approach you've taken, because I've not heard, my fault, I'm not that well read, I've not heard the difference between, as you say, the lotteries and the scratchets versus, say, the pokies. In terms of gambling, you kind of think of gambling as this generic thing. I know everyone knows it's not, but in terms of, is gambling good or bad, or is it causing problems or not? And it sounds to me, I don't think I've heard anybody in the pro or anti-gambling groups say, let's do this but not that, because there is no evidence of harm. I think that's fascinating. Can you maybe, to the extent you've done either the research or you can make a decent supposition, or you're prepared, as I said, to make a guess, why is it that the pokies are addictive and the lotteries are not? What is it that, frankly, I suppose what I'm asking is, what should we look out for? What are some of the kind of key hallmarks? You're like, that's why that thing gets you, or that's why that thing doesn't. At the end of the day, you're putting a couple of dollars down, you're hoping to win the jackpot, or either the pokey jackpot or the jackpot lottery or something. At their face, they are, ridiculously stupid odds of ever getting back your money. You can make a very clear argument they're the same thing. Why are they not?
Yeah, no, that's an excellent question. Yeah, there's been a lot of research into what they call the structural features of the different products that lead some of them to be addictive and others less so. Probably the biggest one is whether or not the gambling is continuous or not. So if it's so the thing about the pokies is you go in there, you sit yourself down, and you get into that state of flow, where, the lights are going off, the sounds are playing, you're pressing the button again and again and again. And what you're getting delivered to you is a set of random rewards, basically rewards of a random size delivered on a random schedule. And you mentioned evolutionary psychology before, and how we're basically monkeys stumbling around in this technological utopia. And, that is it in a nutshell. I'm a big fan of evolutionary psychology, and we always should keep in mind that our brains are there for a purpose. Our brains evolved in order to control our bodies, to get out there in the world, find resources, get those resources, things that we perceive as valuable, things we perceive as good for us, fitness enhancing, and get them and hoard them, consume them, and then have a lot of children. Now, we are very flexible and, in terms of what we perceive as being a reward, and we are able to say, okay, we're getting money or those little coins or whatever the credits are that's been flashed up there. We're very good learners. We've learned that that's the reward, and we have also evolutionarily adapted to be persistent. Because when you're out there foraging out in the real world, you could be hunting or looking for digging up roots, whatever, you're going to have to keep trying it. You're not going to find the bison first chance you get. Sometimes you'll stumble on a massive hoard of food or whatever. Sometimes you'll come up nothing day after day, and you have to keep trying. So these kind of random reinforcement schedules and as well as the continuous experience is a way of basically tricking what is an adaptive impulse to get rewards, and fool us into basically doing something where it's actually a losing proposition, but we perceive it in our guts as a winning proposition.
I'm curious, mate. You talk about that's like, I love that example. It's fantastic. As you're talking about it, I've heard this link before, but it really brought home the linkage between that style of programming or creation, or call it what you want, and video games. The idea of the leveling up in the video games and that kind of the random rewards and the loot box type idea. For those who don't play games, you get to a certain level, you'd open this loot box and you get some random reward from one of a thing to 100 of a thing, or something really great or terrible or whatever it is. To what sense are video games now akin to moneyless gambling in the way they deal with our brains?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of similarities. The really obvious one is that recently they've started incorporating things like those loot boxes, which are basically straight up gambling, into computer games. Sorry, talking too much. Where was I? But on the other hand, computer games generally, they're fun because they are a simulation of that problem solving, resource getting, leveling up, that we human beings enjoy. And the thing is, as entertainment activities, we're attracted to stuff that's easy as well, like physically easy, does not require a huge amount of physical or cognitive effort. And a good computer game, like a good gambling game, it doesn't ask too much of you. So in terms of our behavior, we in a natural environment, we're wanting to optimize the kind of, the minimal effort expended for positive gains and a positive amount of achievement gained. And if you have a choice between doing something that's really sort of easy cognitively and physically, it could be challenging, but just the right amount of challenging. Gambling isn't really challenging at all, most types of gambling. You have skill-based gambling, by the way, of course. I think that's the thing. Computer games also deliver those random rewards and do encourage persistence as well. Yeah.
So from a I guess, again, think about your research in the psychology of gambling and the harm that's being done or where it's being done. Maybe I'll go back to that original question I asked you, would you ban gambling outright? Maybe I can ask a different question of where is the right place to think about when we should level the playing field for us poor monkeys in monkeys in shoes was a phrase I heard the other day. I can't remember where I heard that one. I really like that one. It's monkeys in shoes. If we're just monkeys in shoes, then anytime we're having our evolutionary biology used against us, we are almost by definition at a disadvantage because our rational brains can't overcome that. And there's part of me that thinks, well, anytime it's being done, we are literally being taken advantage of it as a business model and as a regulatory model. That feels pretty rugged to me. At the same time, as you say, if a video game is kind of costless gambling or costless enjoyment, then okay, well, we're being taken for a ride, but it's a fun ride and we don't mind the ride and we don't lose anything other than maybe some sleep because we're still playing at 3 a.m. because we can't quite stop. How do you think about the right? And again, I know you're a regulator or even necessarily a policy guy outright, but where do we think about putting some of those rules around how much can I be taken advantage of and in what ways before someone says, actually, you know what? That's pretty crappy, guys. You've got to stop doing that.
Yeah, that's a good question. And for me, I would say that it's a matter of thinking, well, what is a reasonable price to pay for what is an entertainment experience? Yeah. And, because that's how it's marketed. That's how it's sold. That's how it's presented. This is an entertainment experience. You shouldn't expect to win money. What we are offering is the opportunity to while away an hour or two, have a nice time or have a bit of a flutter on some sort of bet. So in that sense, it's similar to going to watch the movies or going out for, to go out to a nice restaurant or something like that. And, so I would set that as the benchmark. If what is the reasonable price? And when you see somebody who is on a very average income, but is spending hundreds and hundreds of dollars on a particular night for a few hours of this experience, to the extent that they can't pay the rent or other bills, then that's just not a reasonable entertainment experience to be selling.
You do a great podcast. We're going to ask you about it in a minute, but just write down Decoding the Gurus, listeners. You'll want to check that out as we talk. I will get to that in a second, Matt. I want to talk to you about investing because you're not an investment advisor. You're not a financial advisor, so I'm not going to ask you to do any of that. But I have there's a really long history of investors trying to say that's gambling, but this is investing. And therefore, that's bad and this is good. We invest, we don't gamble. And I think that's a useful approach at a surface level for most people. because you get to say to them, look, you know, if you're going to do something with $100, invest it for some sort of positive future expected gain rather than throwing $100 on the dogs, right? As a financial decision, whether you get more fun out of it, as you just said, is a different question. But, you know, backing the fifth in Randwick or putting $100 in an ETF is probably an easier financial decision for most people to make. But I think it's also misleading because it implies investing is a no loss, no risk exercise. And even Charlie Munger, Warren Buffett's partner in crime at Berkshire Hathaway, talks about the fact they are simply looking for mispriced bets, that they are, you know, looking for a horse with, was it 3-2 chance of winning that pays 2-1. They just want a mispriced future value outcome. And that's our job as investors, to say, if I buy shares in Woolies at $35, do I think they're going to be worth more, less, or the same? And we can't know for sure. So we're handicapping the odds. We are thinking about probabilities. We are trying to work out future expected values. And then on the other hand, there is straight out gambling and investing. Every hot stock on every internet chat forum, every cool latest new big thing. I know you keep an eye on the financial markets a little bit. Where do you see those crossing over in terms of the gambling bug that takes hold in the investing markets?
Yeah, I think it's just a fascinating topic. And the history of research into this area, by the way, has looked at investing and gambling at the same time. And as you say, the way us humans evaluate risk and rewards is deeply irrational, frankly. And it is a whole fascinating topic in itself. I mean, there is a reason why insurance companies exist, even though they present negative expected value. Because we are human beings that think about risk like that. And, you know, I myself, I've learned a lot about psychology, to be honest, and myself, by managing my own little personal suite of investments. Yeah, and, you know, even armed with all of the theoretical knowledge about the psychology of this and the emotions that are involved and so on, I'm just as susceptible to the issues as anyone. So I think it's really important. I know that you like to emphasize this too, but it is super important to have that degree of self-awareness, to be able to step back and think, how am I responding to this situation emotionally, and how might that be leading me to maybe make poorer decisions. Again, as you say, there isn't really a fundamental difference between gambling and investing. The only technical difference is, of course, the negative expected value with most forms of gambling. And by the way, there are professional gamblers who can confidently can work with a positive expected value, and they operate in a very similar manner to other types of investors, yeah, where they spread out their bets or investments over a wide range. They make thousands and thousands and thousands of wagers, and they play the odds. Pretty similar to how a good investor is encouraged to diversify their portfolio, right? To reduce that variability.
You will know this, but I was blown away. This is 20 years ago. Blown away. I was working at a company, and the company decided, I'm not sure how wisely, to bring a professional gambler in to talk to us about the Melbourne Cup. It was Melbourne Cup day, so they paid some bloke to come in and tell us about how they do it. And, you know, when you kind of don't know this stuff, you assume that they work out which horse is going to win, they just bet on that horse, and if it's going to win, it wins, and it does really well. And this guy was saying, no, every time I normally back every single horse in the race, and I back it with just varying amounts of money. So I put a large amount of money on the favorite. I put a smaller amount of money on the 100-to-1 chance. And then I spread my bets across so that my expected outcome, to your point, is not I'm going to bet on the winner or I'm going to pick the first three in a trifecta. It's literally I'm going to bet on them all roughly in proportion to the chance I think they're going to win if I get a set of odds across the entire race that's in my favor. And it really does, I think, you know, we sort of have this idea of punters being these, you know, big guys, take their massive wads of cash, they go on, you know, Kerry Packer style, go throw it on the nose of some Melbourne Cup favorite, walk away, shout the bar. But it is real. I mean, a lot of them lose money as well, of course, but it is a really specific, statistically based approach. Can't be done by everyone. You have to know what you're doing, all that kind of stuff. But I was blown away. It just makes perfect sense on one level. But I was just, you know, it's not the general idea you see. And I wonder if that's true. We watch The Wolf of Wall Street, and we hear about, you know, Jordan Belfort, and we watch Wall Street itself, the movie, and Gordon Yekko, and And those sort of characters become the stereotypes for investing, whereas the boring Warren Buffett guy who sits in his, you know, nondescript office in the Midwest of the US without a computer screen and just, you know, reads and reads and reads, you're not going to make a movie out of that stuff. But that's the successful bit. It's not exciting, but that's a successful bit of investing. And I wonder if that's maybe the story of what we get presented with and how we think about them are very different based on just what you see in media.
Yeah, I think so. And I think we have a natural human tendency to want to think about a problem deeply and then come up with a single course of action. And then we sort of almost work to convince ourselves of how good this course of action is, because ultimately we only get to do one thing in the real world. As you say, investing is a little bit different. You can do a multiplicity of different things simultaneously and play those odds. And it's a situation where it is... it's a highly variable, low information environment where you, even the smartest person, will have, you know, relatively little confidence that their decisions are good ones. Yeah.
So you mentioned before, and I love the fact you said, look, you know, I'm a professor of psychology and I still find myself struggling with the same issues that everyone else does. And so again, I'm not going to ask you for financial advice, but as a professor of psychology, what are the things that you know about us as humans, yourself specifically, us as humans, and how do you go about trying to strip back or to overcome the biology that threatens to, throw us off a cliff when we should be actually staying the course?
Yeah. So for me, very personally, I guess what I try to do is, firstly, not take too much credit for any wins that I might be having, because I have to explicitly remind myself that there was luck involved in everything. Because it's easy to convince yourself that you have a certain degree of intuition or expertise or whatever that you don't actually have. Because the reason why you got to maintain that kind of humility is that if you attribute those successes, whatever they are, to your own amazing qualities, then you're going to be encouraged to take bigger risks and double down on risks when you really shouldn't. and the flip side of it too, of course, is that when things don't work out, which is not to panic. And the other interesting thing about stock market or just investing generally is that the returns kind of play out over time. And that's an interesting thing too. So human beings, we always have a natural preference for rewards that come sooner rather than later. And we're conditioned to actually be more highly reinforced by rewards that come quickly. It's no coincidence, again, with the gambling, that the more addictive forms of gambling are the ones which tell you whether or not you've won or lost straight away. Ones like lottery tickets where you have to wait, it's not quite as reinforcing. Yeah.
Hey, I want to ask you a quick question actually about gambling again. I'm going to skip back because just as you're saying, waiting for it, I'm wondering, and I don't want to put you on the spot you're not comfortable with, but I'm thinking about Keno. Now, for those who don't know Keno is I'm gonna butcher it. Say it's a lottery that's run every 2.5 minutes, and so it's kind of like this hybrid of the two. You talk about the lights, and you talked about the ability to kind of play regularly. It's not exactly press like you can play in the pokies, but it's not buy a ticket, wait for a week, or wait for Monday night's draw or whatever. It's on the big screen. It's got the flashing lights. It's got the coming closing soon. Where, either in terms of just the psychology of it or the harm or the kind of continuum of harmfulness or addictiveness, whatever it is, where would Keno sit in your experience? Do you have the research or do you have a sense?
Yeah, look, it sits somewhere in between, which would probably be your intuition, which it has those. It's basically a lottery, but it's been pushed towards being more of a continuous kind of game. In other countries like Canada, their equivalent of poker machines is, they call them video lottery terminals, because technically they're actually lotteries, but they've been modified to essentially function in a very similar way to pokies. Yeah.
Okay, let's move on. I want to ask you about your podcast. You do a podcast called Decoding the Gurus. And I've listened to a lot of those podcasts. They are spectacular tours de force through a whole lot of really cool stuff. Well, actually really uncool stuff, but you make the examination of it quite cool. And largely this is about picking those people who seem to have amassed a guru style following among viewers, listeners, readers. They tend to be certain types of people who have managed to convince a whole lot of people to listen to them, follow them, believe that black is white, and really mess with their heads. And I'm fascinated. Listeners, just honestly, do yourself a favor. Look up Decoding the Gurus, the podcast itself, because it's worth doing. But, Matt, I guess I'm curious from maybe you can just give us a quick summary of what fascinates you about them. Why are these people gurus? Again, I know there's, you know, you could do hours of this on the actual podcast itself, but what is it about them? What is it about gurus? What is it about what, how, and why they do what they do that requires them to be decoded? What is it that's kind of, I will say, leading people astray? They would argue they're not leading people astray. They're being shown the truth, and maybe that's in itself the very example that we need. But what's going on there?
Yeah, well, we fell into this because we noticed the same thing. We saw these characters that were out there that were inspiring these extremely loyal followings, people mm-hmm. who thought that these particular figures just had the answer for everything, that they had this degree of insight, this degree of intelligence, were just like these polymaths who understood everything that was going on in the world. And in this, you know, baffling modern world that we find ourselves in, they were like someone you could go who would have a take on everything and guide you as to what was right, what was wrong, how to think about this, what you should worry about, and so on. Now, in many ways, they were functioning like in the olden days, the spiritual gurus, the your good old-fashioned religious guru who might be preaching on a street corner or might develop a cult around them. But these guys, they're not generally super spiritual or religious. In fact, they present themselves as very logical, very rational, very scientific, very academic in their analysis. So there's a thing on the internet which you would know from being on Twitter, which they call moral virtue signaling, right? Yeah, people that are virtue signaling are like sending this signal to other people that they're a really good person because they've got the right on opinions and they care about the right things. And if you don't agree with them, then you're a bad person. Now, we had a philosopher on who described these gurus as doing intellectual virtue signaling. So these guys present all of the intellectual virtues, very considered, very thoughtful, very learned, and they have the secret to figure out what's going on in the world.
So how are they different, though? So that's a great summary, but that is every false prophet, but also every, I want to say real prophet because that kind of muddies the waters, but every, you know, a Socrates or a Plato, you know, to some degree we revere one lot and we call out the others and we say, well, yes, you know, you're both considered, or you both show that you're considered, and you both think you have the answers, and you both share that to your followers, and you both gain some sort of, I will say, cult following, although I think it's probably unfair to say if Aristotle and Socrates and Plato, but does anything different? Are they the same? If they're not, what differentiates them?
Yeah, I mean, and that's the challenge. They're hard to tell apart from the real thing. And this is why I think they're enjoying so much success in this interconnected social media world that we've built for ourselves, because they can build an audience directly. They don't have to go through editors. They don't have to go through a network or whatever. And how to tell the difference? Well, it's difficult. On one hand, one way to tell is, it's the most difficult way, really, is if you actually know something about the topic that they purport to be an expert on. So
right.
If you, for instance, you know, happen to be a professor of virology mm-hmm. and you are listening to, say, a figure like Brett Weinstein talking about ivermectin and how the vaccines are all very bad for you, then yes. you would know that they were talking bullshit, because you could tell that they were simply bullshit. Making yep. it up. But for the rest of us who aren't lucky enough to be professors of virology, it's a little bit more difficult. Because they, on the surface, they use the right words. They generally have a very professorial tone. They're extremely eloquent, far more eloquent than me. And they sound like somebody you should be trusting. So that, in fact, I think is the way you need to spot them. They go a little bit too hard in terms of acting the role of someone authoritative rather than just being it. I've likened it to the guy that played the president on The West Wing. he did a great job, right? But he was more presidential than any real president in the history of the United States, So one of the ways in which that they can pretend or act like somebody who has, you know, genuine expertise, genuine special insight is the use of something we call pseudo profound bullshit. and that is using needlessly technical terms, using these elaborate metaphors, these elaborate analogies, acronyms and so on. So if you notice somebody using unnecessarily complicated language and expressing things in such a way where it's the language is designed to impress rather than to communicate, then that's an example of a red flag.
And dear listener, if that sounds like the finance industry to you, you're absolutely spot on, because Matt is not that far away from describing most people who would like to be seen to be experts and maybe make it too hard for you to do, possibly yourself, because they know all the big words. What is behind this from the guru's own perspectives? Is it... And they're always different, of course. I'm tempted to think there are some really, really, really super smart people running a massive fraud on the population of America or Australia or the world or whatever. Others are just blowhards who like to believe their own, we'll use the words, use it a few times, believe their own bullshit and want to just show they are cleverer and have influence. Some are just on some sort of, crusade to see the world in their own image or the way they'd like it to be. How much of this is calculated deception? How much of this is just people for their own self-importance who just get on this gravy train of dopamine and can't get off because people love them so much?
Yeah, that's a really difficult question. It's one that we think about a lot because sometimes you can't, you go, is this person for real? Like they must be lying. I think it's good to make an analogy with someone like Donald Trump, just because everyone knows the guy and they know his personality. and if you ask yourself, does Trump deliberately lie all the time? Is he setting out to deceive people? Or does he really believe the stuff that he's coming up with on the spur of the moment, that he's really, God's gift to everything and so on? And I think the truth is that it's more that someone like Donald Trump, who is narcissistic in the same way that a lot of our gurus are, they kind of have a disregard for the truth. It's not so much that they're setting out to lie and deceive necessarily, but for them, they are kind of like the center of the universe, and they feel that being the center of attention and everybody listening to them and them being the smartest person in the world, that sort of feels right to them, I think.
It reminds me, I don't want to get political for its own sake, but I'm reminded of the book that was written about Scott Morrison towards the end of his prime ministership, where the author makes the point that he moves on so quickly, and even the contradictions, he's not lying, because in the moment he believes everything he says, and there's that sense of before and after. I don't know what he might think. I'm not even sure if that supposition is right, by the way. But there was just that sense that in the moment he believes it's true, so he says what he thinks is true, and then he would say something different, or he'd be demonstrably, fact-checked as a lie. But that sense of, this author was saying, I don't think he thinks, he genuinely doesn't think he's a liar, because he genuinely believes what he says when he says it, and then just moves on. I don't want to get political, because it's just a dangerous place to go with listeners and other things. But it strikes me the same kind of thing going on. That idea of if I just say it and believe it, and enough people agree with me, then they're reinforcing the fact that what I said must have been true. And maybe it's true because you lied about it, but then it becomes truth because enough people believe it and tell you you're right. I don't know. It's a strange old world.
No. It's I think that sounds like a decent example as well. I mean, like as humans, we're not primarily interested with the truth. Like it's like being true has become trendy, right? Like science is good. We should all be seeking the truth, trying to figure out what's real and so on. But in terms of what communication was used for in our evolutionary past, it was for status seeking, what they call sexual selection, right? Which is enhancing your prestige, enhancing your role, basically doing politics, doing gossip, and managing a social environment. What's true and what's not true is sometimes relevant, but it's not the most important thing, actually, from an evolutionary point of view. So I guess we shouldn't be too surprised. And we also know that, like, grandiose narcissists, which I think many of our gurus are, they often do very well in society. Like, there is a power to it because they project confidence. They project certainty. And when we see confidence, we see certainty, we think, well, that person clearly knows what they're doing. I'll follow them.
And a bit of reassurance. I'm reminded of the shop assistant who says, oh, sir, you look great in that jacket. Oh, do I? Thank you. That's wonderful to know. I'll buy the jacket. There's a lot to be said of both confidence and then reassuring people or giving them what they want to hear, whether you do it deliberately or not. Maybe that creates its own power. The people who give the simple, honest, straightforward answers that resonate with us, even if they're completely untrue, just, you know, it just makes perfect sense. Maybe that's what Talkback Radio is built on. I'm not entirely sure.
this is one of the problems with the online communication sphere, which is that the people that actually know stuff are not necessarily very good at communication, and they're not really very interested in buttering people up or flattering them. So if you do make that your focus of attention to flatter your audience's intelligence, let them know that they are the good ones and they know what's really going on, perhaps in a slightly conspiratorial sense, then people respond to that. Yeah.
What is it, last question about this, what is it about our psychology or our circumstances that makes us so vulnerable to believing utter crap? The ivermectin one is a fantastic example, right? I can almost understand, not really, but I can almost understand the person who says this should be, you know, we had members of parliament who were famous saying, well, of course we should use it. Thankfully, a former member of parliament. I say that as a former resident of his electorate. Ivermectin was supposed to be great for us. Again, assuming that he's neither the guru in that sense. He's following someone else's guruness. He's the follower. He has a megaphone that he then spreads it. But then he believes it. Other people believe him because believe it because he said it. What is it that makes us vulnerable to believing that crap?
Oh, gee. We'd probably need another hour to get into.
Sorry.
So I can't go into all of the reasons, I think. But I could go into probably one or two of the big ones. And
okay.
I think one of the biggest ones is we all probably have a bit of a tendency towards conspiratorial narratives. Like we have a sneaking feeling, and rightly so, that other people don't want what's best for us, and other people might be wanting to pull the wool over our eyes and are selling us, a bridge over the Hudson or whatever the saying is. So if you think about these narratives, and it could be that, you know, climate change is all of a hoax, you know, that they're just trying to find new ways to tax you because they want to make you poor. The World Economic Forum is a way to create a one world government and oppress you. Really, the doctors want to make you sick get you to
drug companies are all.
Yeah, you know. Yep. And, you know, there is an element of truth in most conspiracy theories. Like, you should be mistrustful of powerful and rich people. Pharmaceutical companies don't always have your best interests at heart. And, you know, sometimes there is government overreach. Mm-hmm. So, but we are probably irrationally conspiratorial. And I think the appeal of things like ivermectin, they really rely on, this is the thing they don't want you to know about, and I've found out about it, and I'm going to share it with you.
Is that evolution as well? You talk about the communication used for social selection. Is that the other side of the same thing, that the very idea that someone else is trying to take your mate or be more impressive or somehow get one over on you? Does it go back that far as well, or am I trying to draw two strings together that don't belong?
I'd have to think about that a little bit. I mean, part of it is just that I think the intrinsic distrust. You can think about it as a bit of an arms race. If you want to manipulate other people and get them to do what you want them to do, it could be just the person at the shop who wants you to buy the jacket. It's not necessarily terribly sinister. Then you're going to be lying to them to one degree or another. You don't really look that good in that jacket, Scott. I'm sorry. So it's in your interest to be always on guard. Is this person trying to trick me? Are they trying to pull, you know, do they really love me as much as they say they do? So I think that because of that arms race, we have two things going on. One is, it's like a dilemma. We need to trust people. We need to find some people who knows what's going on. Like, ultimately, we need to decide whether or not to take a vaccine or take ivermectin. On the other hand, we are also continually fearful of being tricked and taken advantage of. So I think that's kind of what we're seeing.
You made me much less secure. Thank you. I'm now going to go out of this podcast very insecure, distrusting everything, including when I go and see my wife later. Does she really love me as much as she does? Matt, let's finish off with our four. You've been very generous with your time. Thank you. I will share some contact or some follow details for Matt in a minute. But before we do that, let's go to our four favourite questions that our listeners love hearing the answer to. Speaking of ceilings, I've stolen these from other podcasts as well. So full disclosure there. I'm assuming you spend a lot of time with your nose in academic books and papers, but what are you watching and reading at the moment? Or streaming, listening to? What's got your attention?
Well, actually, at the moment, I've been going on a World War One history dive. Yeah, I've been listening to, actually, on, actually, YouTube is how I'm listening to it. And what is it called? It is called... simply called World War One by, what's the author?
G'day listeners, Scott Phillips here. A quick short note, Matt's audio went on the blink from this point forward. So we're going to use the Zoom audio that we recorded as a backup. You'll still be able to hear it in perfectly good quality. Just there will be a change, you'll notice that. But otherwise, enjoy the rest of the interview. It's a cracker.
I'll have to tell you the name of the author. Oh, here we are. Yeah, William Philpott. So it's just a deep dive. So I'm very interested in that, the build up to the war, the way the diplomacy failed and so on. So there's another great podcast, which is called When Diplomacy Fails by a young Irish guy who does a deep dive into the diplomacy prior to World War One that I'm enjoying as well.
Fascinating. I will check that out. I do like some of that stuff. The old line about failing learning from history is always uppermost in my mind. So hopefully some people listening and paying attention to that. Obviously, you spend a lot of time with your mind around psychology and gambling in particular. But what trends are you watching? It can be about what you do as your day job, what's happening in the world, what's happening in society, the economy. What do you kind of get your eye on? Something that's just interesting, grabbing your attention? It can be good, can be bad, can be just straight out interesting. What's grabbing your attention?
I have to say it's the war in Ukraine that I've been obsessive about, and I've never been particularly interested in things like logistics or military operations. But I have to admit I've become obsessive about it to a very large degree. And I think the reason is that I, rightly or wrongly, I kind of see it as a test of the international liberal order that we've had in place kind of since World War II. And kind of relatedly, the kind of sphere of influence, empire building, balance of power type philosophy that existed around World War One, in which these great powers would just gobble up little lands, little peoples, without any regard to what the smaller countries wanted, and of course it ended disastrously. So that's been very much on my mind, and I kind of hope that the world, the democratic Western world, manages to overcome that challenge.
I'm not much of an Elon Musk fan. I have to say I'm impressed with what he's done business-wise. I'm not entirely sure about his some of the other parts of his character, but he put a Twitter poll out asking people on Twitter whether there was a vote that said that Russia should annex parts of Ukraine, whether that should be enough. And I just thought it was an interesting question to ask given what we know about what's happening in Russia and Ukraine. It's also interesting how, if you think about the where power intersects or overlaps, how much you can get away with just by caring less than the other guy. You know, when you're prepared to, and we've seen this so many times through wars around the world, again, I'm absolutely no expert, you know far about more of this than I do, but just that idea of if you're prepared to sacrifice more lives than the other guy, or even in Vietnam more recently, the number of Americans and Australians killed was tiny compared to the number of North Vietnamese died, but they were simply prepared to put more human fodder into, and I use that term deliberately, but not disrespectfully, into the war to the point where, you know, the ability or the willingness of one power to lose more people, lives, money, whatever, it literally is that the party that's prepared to lose more that actually has a disproportionate ability to continue to wage that war.
Yeah, and we see Putin leveraging that in terms of the nuclear brinksmanship and threats that he's orienting towards the West. He knows full well that he is willing to countenance greater risks than probably many people in the West. But by the same token, one of the heartening things we've seen is that when
People like the Ukrainians are fighting for their homeland, and they're fighting against an invader that is destroying their cities, and they're committing numerous war crimes, then that inculcates a willingness to suffer tremendously. And I don't think the kind of coercive control that an autocracy like Putin has cobbled together is really a match for that kind of thing, which is good.
That's true. That's true. I desperately hope you're right. Mate, you've made a working life with a short gap out of spending your time and interest in the academic world. What advice would you give someone who is considering a job in research, in academia, in universities, in the more noble fields of expanding human knowledge?
Well, for a young person, I'd say, first of all, start off studying stuff that you're interested in, that you like. And this is true for undergraduate study or even getting into postgraduate stuff. But at the same time, keep in mind, what does the world need from you? Don't be too solipsistic about it. Don't just indulge your interests. And, there's some bad advice that's given, which is just follow your passion and don't listen to what the world's telling you. Just barrel ahead. But no, research is about solving real world problems and questions that actually matter to people. So keep that in mind as well, and try to find that sweet spot where you've got the stuff that you're passionate about, the stuff that you're good at, and the things that people need you to do. And if you can find that sweet spot, you should be golden.
Excellent, excellent advice. My last question, my favorite question. I'm an optimist by nature. I sense you might be, although maybe you'll tell me otherwise. What are you optimistic about?
That's weird, because I am an optimist by nature, definitely. I feel like everything is going to get sorted out. We're gonna figure out climate change. I'm super happy that solar panels are getting cheap now, and I feel like we are going to figure these problems out. I'm optimistic about Australia. I think the more I look overseas and the more I look at the kind of social problems and culture wars that happen elsewhere, I have to admit, I feel this sneaking sense of national pride, which is not something I think is cool or as a young person would have said without cringing, certainly. But, I think in terms of a relatively happy, harmonious place where we have a multicultural society, and getting that balance right between, like you said, well-regulated capitalism, like the right amount of regulations. Sometimes we probably have too many regulations. just providing a place where people can, prosper and flourish. So I feel like we can keep doing it, and hopefully more places around the world will be similar.
Mate, we've talked about your podcast, Decoding the Gurus. I hope our listeners all subscribe after this conversation is finished. How else can people stay in touch with you, whether it's social media or any other way? If they want to kind of keep tabs on what you're doing and what you're thinking and what you're sharing, where can they go?
Well, I have a professional account on Twitter, but I have a highly unprofessional account, which is
love it.
Which is under a pseudonym, which is an open secret, and that it's me. But I'll tell your viewers the secret, which is Arthur C. Dent.
Okay.
So this is after Arthur Dent from The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Yes.
But Arthur Dent was taken, so it's Arthur C. Dent.
Right. Okay, very good. Arthur C. Dent. Excellent. And that's the best place to hear your musings and see what's going on in your world.
Absolutely.
Well, I know him as Arthur C. Dent on Twitter, but the world knows him, thankfully, as the Professor of Psychology at Central Queensland University. He is Professor Matthew Brown. Thank you for joining us on The Good Oil.
Thanks, Scott. This is great.
This podcast is hosted by me, Scott Phillips, produced by Ed Gooden, and imaged by Link Kelly.